There's a famous quote from like Jack Kirby that comics will break your heart. Comics will break your heart if you don't understand how comics work when you go to make comics. If you understand how it works, you understand what a freelance deal is, what it is that you're giving up, what it is you should be getting. If you understand what final order cutoff date is, if you understand what bleed is, if you understand what a page rate is and what it isn't, you understand all of these things, what royalties are and all this other kind of stuff, you can have less trepidation and less nervousness about the process, which will help make you more confident to go make the comic you want to make.
Hey, comic creators, artists, writers, world builders, this is your call to action. Here at Talking Comics, we love diving into the stories behind the story. Whether you're just starting out or you've been in the game for years, we want to hear your journey, your creative process, and what fuels your imagination. So, ready to talk comics with us? Message us or hit the link in our bio and be a guest on Talking Comics.
I'm excited about this one. Like, I love talking lawyer stuff, so that's so much fun. You know?
Okay, that's weird. You know that, right? That's not a normal thing for people who are not cursed in the profession.
Cursed in the profession. Okay,
yes.
I'm going to write that down because I'm going to bring that up later.
Yeah, the vast cursed? Majority of lawyers I know, especially entertainment lawyers and lawyers who work in comics, they really want to write comics. They really want to direct. They really want to, but they realize they're probably not going to make any money doing that. So they do what we do. It's not necessarily something that anyone wants to do, but it is a necessary evil. So we're in it.
Right. It's a necessary evil. And like, I feel like, hold that thought. We're going to get into this. Awesome. Well, welcome to Talking Comics. We have Jamal Hennessy with us. He's a lawyer in this space, in the comic space. But before we jump into like all my fun lawyer questions, even though you used to call me a nerd for calling them fun, that's fine. I'm okay with that title. Just give us a little bit about yourself, background, that kind of stuff.
My name is Jamal Hennessy. I am an attorney, author, and business consultant who specializes in the comic book industry. I've worked in the industry since the late 1900s. I got my first job in 96, and I worked for I was in-house counsel for a Japanese animation company called Central Park Media, which also that we did anime and manga. We licensed most of the material directly from Japan. And I was working there for about 4 years until Marvel decided they wanted to break into the Japanese market. So they hired me to be the international publishing manager. And I did that for about 2 years. One of the things, because Marvel's the type of company, if they hire you to do one thing, you're actually going to be doing three or four things when you actually get the job. One of the things that I was doing was I did a lot of the contracts bringing in talent to Marvel right around the time that the initial Ultimates line was jumping off, and they were doing Wolverine Origins and they were doing all sorts of things. And what I realized was that a lot of the artists and writers that came in all grew up reading Marvel Comics. So if you give that type of person a contract where you're telling them you may be drawing Spider-Man, you may be drawing Wolverine, you may be drawing Captain America, they are prone to not really pay attention to what the contract says.
They just want to be there.
They don't even, yeah, this is what they want to
do. Sign their name and go.
But I would tell them, take this to your attorney, tell me what they think. They didn't, almost never did that. What in most cases, they would take it away, they would wait what they thought would be a reasonable amount of time, and then they would sign it. And I realized they didn't understand what it was that they were doing. So when I left Marvel, I started a firm basically designed to just help people figure out what it is that they were signing. I knew they were going to sign it anyway, but I wanted them to know what it was they were signing. And I did that for a few years, but the industry itself started to splinter off and multiply into a lot of different opportunities, where creator-owned deals became like a huge thing. People had the ability through high-speed internet to start their own publishing companies, and they needed help as well. Then you had the webtoons. That started. Then you had crowdfunding. And that also started. You had people doing independent product lines based on their comics. You had people getting option agreements from Hollywood. So as all of these different opportunities kind of spread out across the industry, my practice grew. And in, I want to say 2020, I actually wrote the first book that was in a series. It was called The Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing. And the goal of that book was to walk someone through the entire process of building a comic book company, from the initial idea that you had that you were going to make comics, all the way up to the idea that you have a growing catalog and you have an ongoing business. That book did fairly well. And then in 2023, I did the follow-up book, which was called The Business of Freelance Comic Book Publishing, which is designed to help someone become a professional freelance comic book creator, because there's the ideas in the, as an independent creator, what motivates you, what your goals are, and the goals of a freelance comic book creator are almost inverse. I actually had to write another book to kind of encapsulate that business process. I am now in the process of rewriting The Business of Independent Comic Book Publishing. So by the time the fifth anniversary of the book is available, the book will be published. And we've also expanded out our offerings, not just to legal situations, but we're also helping from a business development standpoint. So we'll be helping with protecting intellectual property, forming companies, marketing, distribution, printing, talent management, pricing, sales, and all the rest of it. But other than that, I don't know very much about comics.
Is that all of that that you, the last part you just said there, that you're helping with businesses, start businesses and stuff, or I guess incorporate them or whatever. Are you limited by state to be able to do that, or can you do that nationwide?
No. I'm actually, right now, I have one client who's asked me to start one of his companies in Maine. Last week, it was North Carolina. A couple months ago, I had two clients who started companies in California. The thing about being in the comic book industry, which is different than being an attorney for other types of business, is you are not necessarily limited geographically, because comic books themselves are a geographically dispersed medium. The writer and the artist are probably living in completely different cities and may only see each other at conventions, and it's going to be the same for the letterer and the colorist and the publisher and the editor. So the attorney doesn't necessarily have to be, I mean, I'm in New York City, but you don't have to be in New York City to do this kind of work. I know that there are attorneys familiar with comics who work out of Michigan and Jersey and Florida and California. As long as your clients can find you, then it's not limited by state at all.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So it makes me happier, because anybody listening to this can hire you, right?
Exactly.
You're like, heck yeah. I might have to call you after the show. Because, I mean, not only am I excited because I just like this kind of conversation because I'm weird, but also, I mean, that's a situation I'm in too, right? So I have a startup podcast. I'm sole proprietor, been a sole proprietor in many things over the years. I incorporated once with a company, an S Corp. I hated it. It was so bad. I don't know why we did it. We thought we needed it. It really didn't go anywhere. COVID kind of killed us, right? As for 1,000 companies, you know, thousands of companies out there. But now that I'm like starting this and getting back into it and I'm writing my own comic, it's like, okay, what point for a person in my situation is the right time to say, okay, I need to get this LLC or this corporation or whatever?
The best time to decide whether or not you need to form a company and to form a company is after you do one of two things. Well, both of these things. One, figure out why it is you're making comics. What is the goal? Because if your goal is simply artistic expression and you're not necessarily worried about profit margins, you're not worried about longevity and anything like that, then forming a company becomes less important. if this is going to be the foundation of your entire intellectual property empire, forming a company is more important. The second thing you need to do is figure out how this process is going to get financed. You can't make money in comics until you put some money into the process. You have to figure out where that money is going to come from, when that money is going to show up. And at that point, you now have the third thing. You have to figure out what comic is going to be the first comic you're going to make. Because once you have that idea, you write that idea down, you now have intellectual property. So you have a goal, you have the intellectual property, and you have the finances to get everything off the ground. That's when it's the time to say, yes, I need to form a company. I probably need to find an accountant. I probably need to find an attorney. I probably need to find an editor. Before you actually go out into the world looking for talent to make the comic, before you go out to do marketing, before you do any of those things, establishing the firm foundation is going to be the most important. And once you have, again, the idea written down, the money to get it started, and it's not going to necessarily be in a ton of money because the barrier for entry in comics is not that high, then you form the company, you bring in the professionals who you need to actually make sure everything goes the right way, and then you go make comics.
So a lot of people, I would say, probably skip ahead. Just going to use my personal experience here.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. In about 70-75% of the cases, here's what happens. A writer will find an artist. They'll start talking about an idea. They'll get really excited about it. Next thing you know, the writer is sending scripts and the artist is doing character design. No one has actually talked about what kind of deal it is, what kind of book it is, who's paying for it, who's owning it, or anything. They just get really excited. And there have been quite a few times, and it's actually getting better. It was far worse 2015, 2016. But it used to be the case that people would contact me after they already had a Kickstarter. The Kickstarter was already successful. They already had the money. And now, we need to negotiate the contract. Okay, I mean, that's literally wrong, but let's do it your way. Nowadays, people are coming to me earlier and earlier in the process. And I don't know if it's all of the things that I've written about, don't do that, or all of the podcasts that I've been on that don't do that, or people just figured it out on their own. I don't know, but it's better now than it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, in my personal dealings, right, what's happened to me personally, it's always been, I'm funding all this out of my pocket myself, right, mm-hmm. on anything I've done, and it's like, I don't know. It's like I always felt like I needed to be making money before I needed to start the company. Because like when I'm spending money, yeah, I can write it off as a sole proprietor, everything like that. I still get most of those benefits. I don't get the protection, right, mm-hmm. that an LLC gets you liability-wise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like, man, I'm not making any money. I'm just spending money. Now I'm going to spend even more money to start a company. Now I got to spend more, you know what I'm saying? It's like, but at the same time, I have created a mascot, right? Like mm-hmm. I have a mascot for the, that should be probably trademarked, you know, the name should be trademarked or copyrighted. I need to copyright the book. You know, I have hired an artist, right? Mm-hmm. I'm paying, you know, for artwork for, you know, a page rate, right? I wrote the script and, you know, our deal now is I give him copies. When we're done, I'm going to give him, he's welcome to sell as many copies as he wants. You know, he can get them at like wholesale or whatever. I'm going to give him some, of course. And I'm paying him for that. Is there any issue? Like if I called you to your office tomorrow and I said, hey, I need, you know, I want to go ahead and get this all legal, like, right. You know, let's get it all incorporated. What's the transfer like? Like, okay, I have this comic book idea. I have a script. I have all this stuff. How do I transfer that into the company at that point?
Well, there's a couple documents that you can have written that's basically going to be a transfer of ownership document. You basically say, I own this intellectual property, I own this amount of money, or I signed these contracts. You transfer all of those all of those assets to the company. So now the company owns the assets.
Gotcha.
That way, if there's any kind of legal issue where somebody comes after the company for something that the company did, they cannot go after your assets as long as you've done things the right way. So your bank account, your house, your car, protected.
Right.
The assets that the company owns are subject to whatever legal scrutiny of whatever happens, and that's fine. The other issue is if you need to show chain of title, like let's say somebody wants to take your comic, make it into an animated series, there you go. You have to show them the copyrights, the trademarks, all the contracts. If it's all squared away with one company, you just send them one Dropbox file, say, this is the chain of title. Thank you very much. Here's where you should send all my money. If some of it's in your name or you don't have contracts for certain things, and the muddier it becomes, the less anyone's going to be interested in taking a risk on that work, because the last thing they want is to greenlight something for $10, $50, $100 million, then realize they're getting a cease and desist letter because you never actually owned the stuff that you were trying to sell, and the whole thing is foobar. Nobody wants that. So, putting it all in the company actually protects your personal assets and gives the company more inherent value.
And that's even if I want to infuse more money into it, right? So if I've spent, say, $1,000 on my comic so far, and then we transfer that, and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to put another $1,000. That's like an owner investment or some kind of legal term for that.
Your operating agreement will say what your initial contribution to the business is going to be. And in most operating agreements, there's also a provision that says you are allowed to put more money in, but you are not obligated to put more money in. And since every company, every LLC needs to have a separate bank account from the individual who owns it, you could keep putting money in there to cover operating costs from the company. And depending on how your operating agreement is set up, you may also be able to recoup some of that money once profits are generated. So let's say you put in $2,000 in the company to get the book out the door, then you do a Kickstarter and you make $5,000. You would have every legal right to take the initial $2,000 you put in and take it out because you're actually recouping your investment. As long as you actually have documentation of everything that's happening, you should be fine.
That's pretty cool. So I've heard this term, especially when I went through this corporation. I told you before I went through a corporation years ago. This term called, piercing the corporate veil, right? And I used to argue with the bank all the time because they wanted my name on it. And I'm like, I'm not putting my name on it. Like, I'm not signing for this. The company's signing for it. And they're like, well, we don't care. You're signing for it. How do you navigate that?
Well, in many cases, if you're what's called a single member LLC, what the bank is trying to do, the bank is trying to go past your corporation and attach you to all of the transactions because they are guessing that your single member LLC doesn't have a lot of assets.
Right.
So if they could get you to sign all the documents as an individual, then if something happens and they need to go after assets, they want to go after yours. They don't want to go after your companies because they know your company doesn't have very much. What some people do, depending on your level of affluence and how much money you actually have, is, and depending on your financial situation, I've had clients a long time ago who every time this individual, he was an angel investor. And every time he was going to do an investment, he would form another company. That company would then put money into that company, and that company would then make the investment. The investment was lost. He couldn't care less because it was basically just a tax write-off as far as he was concerned. In certain cases, however, he took a lot of his money and put it into corporations. So when someone wanted to come after him and his assets, it's like, well, that's fine. You could come after me and my assets. I don't have anything. It's actually the company. So if that kind of shell game is a more sophisticated financial vehicle that I do not necessarily recommend for people in the comic book industry, but if a financial institution is telling you they want you to sign personally, then you could just take all your cash and put it in the thing that they don't want you to sign under because they think that has no asset. Well, guess what? Now you have no assets and the company has. But it is a shell game. Like I said, I do not recommend for the comic book.
Right. That's crazy. But then again, if you're trying to borrow money, they want somebody that has the assets or the backing, which at that point you pierce it and you're unless you move it all into the company, like you just said.
Exactly. Or you transfer it to your spouse, or you transfer it to your child, or you transfer it overseas in like the Cayman Islands.
Okay, I don't know if I want to go into that.
Yeah, how many comic book companies are doing all of that? I mean, slow down. Yeah. We're just trying to make comics.
Yeah, does you know Image Comics have Caribbean bank accounts? Is that what we're saying?
I cannot confirm or deny what bank accounts Image may or may not have.
That's fantastic. I love this. So you talked about these comics that these kids at Marvel or just people signing at Marvel, you know, just putting their name on it because they want to draw Spider-Man. What are some of the red flags that you would tell somebody that's excited, you know, jumping in? What's some of the biggest red flags?
And this is over like 20, 25 years, I've come up with this system to explain to basically artists and creative people how to look at a contract. And it's basically, you have to look at the interplay between four factors. The four factors are your rights, your revenue, your responsibility, and your recovery. Every paragraph in the contract deals with one or more of those factors. And if you can analyze the contract and understand how each one of those factors impact you, you will then understand if this is a good deal or a bad deal. So for example, if I say the creator-owned deal and the rights that I'm giving up are the publishing rights, the merchandising rights, the movie rights, the interactive rights, the TV rights, the live performance rights, I'm basically giving up all the rights. Now, in a creator-owned deal, really, the only rights that a comic book publisher needs is the print and digital publishing rights. If they want all the other rights, then they should be paying for all the other rights. There's no reason for you to give away basically ownership and control of the story that you've been working on unless you're being paid for it. So then you look at the next part of the contract. What are you getting for these rights? If you're getting $5,000 as an advance or no advance at all, then the question becomes, why are you giving up the movie rights to a story you made for no money? Now, if the next part of the contract says you're going to get $125,000 and 5% of the production budget with a cap of like $10 million, I'm like, okay, sure, give it to them, because what you're giving up and what you're getting actually match. It's where the things are out of whack that's where a bad deal comes from. So for example, if I say, well, I'm a publisher, you give me the rights to your comic, and I tell you that the length of time I'm going to have the rights to your comic is the term of the copyright. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is, with modern copyright, if you file a copyright in 2025, the length of the copyright is your life plus another 70 years. So what you're saying, what I'm saying to you as the writer, is you're going to give me the rights to this comic for the rest of your life, for most of your kids' life, and maybe your grandkids might be able to get the rights back, but probably not. Question then becomes, okay, what did you give me for that? Because you've basically taken this property off the table for me forever. And again, if they said, we'll give you $125,000 plus 5% of the production, okay, sure, go for it. But if they're not giving you anything, then why did you give that to them? It's once you figure out what it is that you're getting for what it is that you're giving up, then you can understand whether a contract is good or bad.
That's great. So it's like the four R's. What are they? Writing,
It is rights, revenue, responsibility,
rights and, revenue.
And recovery. I made them all start with R so I can remember what they were.
Right. Responsibility and recovery. Yeah, that's next time I read a contract. That's what I'm going to do. Not that I have many coming my way, but that's fine. I'm just going to send it to you. Like, should I sign this? You know, I thought a lot about that, actually, you know, for like if there's like sponsor deals and stuff like that for a podcast, which I'm not saying it's going to happen today, but a year, mm-hmm. 2 years from now could happen. You know, you gotta protect yourself and all of how that works. So, man, this is amazing. I know you're laughing at me, but I love this stuff.
You are one of the few comic book writers that actually wants to hear about this level of intricacy, because in most cases, writers that I deal with, they want to create their own deal. They see Image as kind of like the holy grail of like getting a deal. And when they bring me their deal, what they really want me to tell them is that this is a good deal. You should sign it. Go make your copy. In most of the cases, I tell them either this is a bad deal or this is a horrible deal, or this is not the worst deal that I've read in the world. Here's what you could change. Most of the time, they don't want to hear any of that because they might have spent 2 years, 3 years, 5 years trying to get any publisher to offer them a deal. If I then come in and tell them the deal that you've been waiting for is a deal that you should walk away from, in most cases, they do not. In most cases, they just sign it. But at least then they know, yeah, that's a bad deal.
Do you have anybody that, like, do they have negotiating power to go back? And have you seen them get changes done and still get a deal?
It depends on two things. One, it depends on the level of leverage that the writer or artist has relative to the publisher. And it depends on the ability of the writer or artist to walk away. If the writer or artist knows that they have 10,000-15,000 followers on social media, they've had 4 or 5 successful Kickstarters that they've backed already, and all of a sudden someone offers them a deal, they can go, okay, I can take what you just offered me, or I can do what I'm already doing and I know that it works. And if what you're offering me is less than what I'm getting on my own, why would I do that? And those artists and writers can go in and get, because at that point, they're not really looking for their first deal. They're looking for expanded distribution channels for a business they've already set up. They have much far more leverage, and it's much easier for them to get the deal they want. A person who hasn't made a comic, hasn't published a comic, and is trying to break in with a creator-owned deal has much less leverage. And therefore, I mean, unless you came from another type of media where you already have a following, like, I don't know, and this is a stupid example. Keanu Reeves didn't have a comic book before Berserker. But when he did the Berserker deal, he got a good deal because he's Keanu Reeves.
Because he's Keanu Reeves, right. Yeah, exactly. Nobody's beating down AJ Ryman of Talking Comics, you know, host of Talking Comics door down yet. So,
okay. But once you actually star in several like multi-million-dollar franchises, then you too can just go walk into Boom and get whatever deal you want.
Get whatever you want. That's fantastic. So I know you've done videos on this before because I've, you know, I watch your stuff because I love this kind of stuff. But for us, for our audience, the trademark versus copyright, you know, we'll use me for example, you know, Panel Pete here, my mascot. What's the process to trademark something like that?
But keep in mind that a trademark is going to be a word, a symbol, a phrase, or a sound used to sell a particular type of good and service. So in your case, you have a mascot that you're using to promote the podcast that you have. The way it works when my client comes to me with something they want to trademark, I take a look at their trademark and I see if there's any pre-existing trademarks that are going to be in conflict with your mark. Because a trademark is, people think a trademark is designed to help the person who owns the trademark. And from a legal standpoint, it is not. The trademark is designed to help the public determine where goods and services are coming from. So if I go into the store and I pick up a bottle of Coca-Cola, I would like to know that it actually came from Coca-Cola and not some random dude behind the supermarket with a bathtub with, you know, a lot of sugar, right? In the same way, I have to make sure that your trademark, your potential trademark, isn't going to confuse the public because it looks like another thing from another company that already exists. Once we figure out how to make sure that your mark is not in conflict with anybody else's, then we file a trademark application. A trademark application is different from a copyright registration because a copyright registration, for all intents and purposes, you're just informing the Library of Congress, I made this thing, it's mine, please make a record of it. With the trademark application, you're asking to get a trademark. You may not get it. And there's two ways you could actually apply for it. There's what's called an in-use application, which means you already, like you already have it on your hat, you're already selling the hats. Now you want a trademark for your character or hats. So you file the trademark. The other is what's called an intent to use application, which means you have the character. You plan on selling hats. You're not really selling the hats yet. You're kind of building up to it. Either way is fine because the trademark office, it takes about 12 to 18 months for the trademark office to get back to you and say, yes, you can, or no, you cannot have this trademark. So if you, let's say you're planning in 2026 to start selling hats, we file the trademark application now and we file an intent to use application. By the time the trademark office asks you to prove you're using the trademark, because you can't just sit on a trademark. You can't say, I'm going to sell hats and t-shirts and toys of this character and then never do it. Because the trademark office wants the marks available for people who are actually using. So by the time 12, 16, 18 months comes around, they'll say, are you using this mark? You can say, actually, yes, I am. You send them the website link that shows that you're selling hats to the public. It doesn't matter how many hats you sold. You could have sold zero hats.
Right.
But if somebody can buy the hat that has your trademark on it, which is what the trademark office is looking for, then you get a trademark. And that trademark will last you for about 6 years. And then the trademark office will ask you again, are you still using it? Or did your company burn out and you're not doing anything with it anymore? If you're still using it, we file a registration statement that says it's still in use. And then you go on selling your hats or whatever. It's fine. That's it. That's the whole process.
See, I never knew that about trademarks. Now, what about when I copyright the comic, who my comic, this is the main character of my comic book too? You know, does that help or hurt? Or,
well, there are different processes that are related. Let's, the fact that you have a trademark in something is not necessarily going to help you get a copyright. And the fact that you have a copyright in something is not necessarily going to help you get a trademark. But what the copyright's going to do is the copyright's going to protect the story that you are telling and all the elements in the story. What a trademark is doing is protecting the word or image that you're using to sell the comic. So the example that I always use is Batman. Because if I tell you I read a story or I wrote a story about a rich young man who survives a tragic criminal event and then uses his money to become a vigilante outside the law, I've just told you a story. It is, Batman is a specific expression of that story and gets a copyright. But keep in mind, if you look at the story I just told you, I also just told you the story of Moon Knight, Iron Man, Iron Fist, The Shadow, Nighthawk, and like 50 other characters. But each one of those is a specific expression of that idea. Each one gets a copyright. If in my story, the rich young man happens to have some sort of animal totem fetish and puts a bat on everything. And me as the publisher also puts a bat on everything that could be nailed down to sell them. Those are going to be trademarks. It's not the story. The story is the rich young man who becomes a vigilante. The symbol that I put on the t-shirt is the trademark. That's what I use to sell things, including the comic. But I sell the trademark. I use the trademark to sell the comics. I also use the trademark to sell other things, because I have now created an emotional connection between that symbol and the story. So if I put that symbol on a lunchbox, I can now sell lunchboxes. Lunchbox had nothing to do with the story. Nobody cares, because they see the symbol and that's what they gravitate.
That's fantastic. Or sell pictures that I have behind me, or pops, or whatever else that I have in this room.
Literally, like, one of the things that I had to do when I was at Marvel was we had to handle a lot of the licensing agreements, because Marvel at that point, this was like when Tobey Maguire was the only Spider-Man that we had. But I came to the conclusion that there was not one thing, not one article that a consumer can buy that Marvel did not put Marvel characters on. So whether you're talking about socks or drapes or cans of ravioli or hats or sneakers or bottles of water, nobody cared. Find it, make a license, get some money, send them the pictures. It'll be great. It'll be great.
Everything.
Literally everything.
So this is a could be a real world scenario. I'm gonna show you a picture here on my phone. So in my comic, right? So part of what I've been doing is my comic is part of it is set inside a comic shop, because Panel Pete lives in a comic, right? He's in a comic book shop, gets bought, does some cool things, but inside the comic shop is a bunch of comics, right? So I've been asking a lot of the people that I've interviewed that have created their own comic book to use their comic in my book as a, you know, something to, you know, just like an homage to the indie community, to have their book in my comic. But now, like, there's just stuff like this. I don't know. Hopefully that's clear.
Can't see that at all.
No, I can't. Yeah, it may not be. I might have to email it to you real quick. So what, I'll just explain it. What if I had like this comic, a Thor comic, on the shelf in my comic book, on the comic book wall? Is that legal? Am I allowed to do that or no?
Well, you have to understand the difference between legal reality and financial and actual reality. Because what you should do in all cases that you're going to use someone else's intellectual property in your intellectual property is get a release. And it should be written. So like every person that comes onto your show and says, yes, you could use my comic in your, you know, in the background in your comic, it'd be very helpful if you got a written release signed from them.
That says, emails, does that count?
It would be very helpful if you got a written release that allows you to do that, as opposed to an email, which is not as helpful. And for every time that you use a comic book in the background that you do not own, that is going to technically be infringement, improper product placement and infringement. Now, unless several factors would have to come into play for Marvel and Marvel's legal department to decide to send you a cease and desist letter. One of those things would have to be that you sold enough copies of this comic, or people knew enough about this comic to recognize that this actually occurred. If they never see it, they can't sue you for it. They can't send you a cease and desist. So if you sell 3 copies and it's in there, like, well, great. You sold 3 copies and there's no problem. If you sold, like, for some whatever reason, you sold 300,000 copies and there's something pivotal in the panel that had the Thor comic in it, Yeah, now you're going to get a cease and desist letter. Now the army of ninja lawyers that Marvel incorporates will swoop down onto your residence and strip you of everything that you have ever had.
Unless I have an LLC, then they can only take the comic, right?
Yes, but they will attempt to pierce that corporate veil. Let's be honest. They will attempt.
Really?
See, because the thing that separates, well, there's a lot of things that separate independent and emerging comic book creators from companies like conglomerates like Marvel and DC. Marvel and DC they just have lawyers just waiting around to do things.
Just and, like this.
Yeah,
they're waiting like, for this situation right here.
And they bill by the hour. So the more they can find things to go after you for, the more they make. And not everybody's happy because you're not going to. So I would recommend, and a lot of times my clients will send me their, they'll send me their scripts or they'll send me their final pages for what's called a infringement review. So I look at every panel of the comic and say, okay, do you have name, image, likeness rights for this person? Because this person looks very much like a current Hollywood star. Do you have the right to actually use this logo in the background? Do you have, and invariably the answers are no, they don't have rights to do any of that. But, you know, there are things, there are ways around it. Like, for example, a question I get a lot is, can you use like monuments in a skyline of a particular city in your establishing shot, or is that infringement? The fact is, that's not infringement. If you like, let's say you have the skyline of Paris and in the background there's the Eiffel Tower, then you're fine. You don't have to get any permission to do that. However, if you take a shot of your establishing shot is Paris at night, and the light show on the Eiffel Tower is part of your background, you now have to get permission from the commission that runs the Eiffel Tower, because the light show is copywritten. The building itself is a public work, and you could do that. So
what's the, I totally understand what you're saying. Just throwing out something else here. Is there any issue of having this stuff in my background, or is it because I purchased it under a license, I'm okay?
Well, the reality, this is again the difference between legal reality and, you know, real world like life.
Right.
Marvel, companies like Marvel and DC, I believe, have come to the collective understanding that when podcasters use their stuff in the background, or when artists are making commission pieces in Artist Alley, or when people are cosplaying as their characters, this is a level of free marketing that they cannot replicate without allowing this to happen. So I think on a certain level, just from establishing intellectual property and establishing the value of the characters itself, they're actually not at all upset that you've got the Batman Joker like poster behind you, and you've got the classic Spider-Man on the wall, and you've got the Batman Funko, and I've got a whole lot of Moon Knight because it's October and I figured Halloween, Moon Knight, whatever. And the Funkos and everything else. You're not actually removing any money from these companies by putting those things up. You're actually, depending on how you look at marketing, you're helping them out. So they don't worry about it.
Well, that would be the same argument I have for my comic book. I'm helping market them.
Yes, but you are selling the comic.
Right.
And people are watching the podcast for free. Well, free in that the only thing they're paying is their attention. They're not actually paying money. Yeah,
because unless I had like a subscription service, but I do offer this for free too, though.
If you are making considerable amounts of money from, and it was specifically tied to the use, like if you were using the Funkos or the comics as props or something, and that was generating a lot of cash, then that would actually be in an infringement that they would take notice of. What we're doing now is probably an infringement that they couldn't care less about, because there's too many podcasters with Funkos in the background.
And there's 20 people that are going to see this episode, right, for you know, the next six months. So, and then it'll
most of these podcasters have no money, so there's no point going after them.
What are you going to get? You want my Thor? This is my prized possession right here. This Thor comic right here that's, you know, beat all the hell.
Yeah. So it's like not worth it.
That's, oh my God, that's fantastic. Because I hated that, walking through a convention and seeing all these people that are doing art, you know, selling what I would consider, like, I would never want to do that, like, draw Thor and then sell it, right? Like, I draw a line personally there, right? I wouldn't want to take buy my daughter something that was, you know, they don't have the license for that, but I'm understanding it more now, especially going through this project to write my own comic, right? And the use of those kind of things. So, God, I love this stuff. And we need to, like, move on, or we're going to be here all night. Because I will have you back every week. What is... I always ask this. I think we've talked about a lot of really cool things. I'm geeking out over this. But is there something... You've written books, right? Have you written a comic book? Have you done a comic book?
No, I have actually written... Hold on. I've written six novels and four nonfiction books. And I came to a conclusion very early in my career as a fiction writer that it takes a very specific type of confidence in your creativity to write a comic book script and then hand that script over to an artist and then a flatter and then a colorist and then a letterer, because you are confident enough in your craft that you want to see what other people are going to do with your words. I, on the other hand, I do not like to share. So I know the ideas, I know the beats that I want in the story. I know the narrative arc that I want in the story. I know the visuals that I would like to project into the head of the reader as I'm doing it. And I am not willing to give that process, share that process with other people, even though I know they would probably enhance it and make it better. I am much more willing to sit and just write out like the entire novel. Like the last project I did was a series of short stories that I released only on audio. So I wrote the story, because when you write a story, but you're writing it for the ear instead of the eye, you have to write it in a different way, because there's a lot of visual cues that a person reading a story will take to figure out who's talking and what's going on and everything else. And I did that for maybe a year, year and a half, but I was not willing to go out and hire a voice artist, a voice actor to do it. I recorded all of them myself. And I sat there and I figured out how to do it, because I knew how I wanted it to come across. And I understand that if you're not willing to share the art creative process with other people cannot enhance your work, which I think is one of the magic parts of comics. But I also know my own mentality, and I'm like, I can't do it.
I agree. I am definitely one of those people that have to do everything myself. I have to have like control it and everything. And I don't know what changed, but it was being inspired by this community, really, is what happened. Was interviewing these creators and wanting to go through the process myself to learn just that much more, right, of writing a comic. So I wrote the script, taking tips from, you know, TikTok videos and, you know, that Stephanie puts out or all these other creators puts out. And I did it. I wrote it. I'm like, okay, cool. And then I, like, if I were to do the artwork, it would have taken me 10 years, you know, because I would have to literally learn the skill of drawing, because I don't know that well. And I finally was like, well, I'm interviewing all these creators. Why don't I just hire an artist? And I did. It was one that I, you know, interviewed. We hit it off. He sent me some fan art of Panel Pete, and you know, I was like, I asked him to do a cover, like an alternate cover, right? And he did that. And I was like, dude, just do the whole book, you know? And, you know, I'm paying him to do it. But, and it's just been, it's amazing to get that, to experience that in something that I wrote. He sends me pages of artwork of something that I wrote. And it's like, this is really cool. So it's cool. It's a cool experience. But I'll have to make it all legal here soon. You know, when Marvel comes after me for my, you know, Journey into Mystery 109 as my prized possession back here. No, that's great. And so where can people get all your books? Because I'm buying some.
You can find all my stuff. You can find on Amazon. You can also find it on like Barnes & Noble. You can find it on like Target. You can also just go to GamalHennessy.com. Because all of the stuff that I've done, both fiction and nonfiction, is on that website. You could also go there if you want a free legal consultation on something that you're working on. If you want to sign up for my newsletter, if you sign up for the newsletter right now, you will automatically get access to a video that I've done that actually walks you through screen by screen how to register the copyright for your comic.
That's
free. I have a
that's podcast. On your website?
Yeah, it's on my website. Sorry. If you just click the button that says click here for newsletter, it'll click you to the newsletter, you join the newsletter, and then you should get the video as like the next email that you get.
Perfect. Sorry. Yeah.
And I also have a podcast that I do once every 2 weeks called the Business of Comics Podcast, where I talk about the major news stories for the past 2 weeks. Then I give a little bit of commentary on like foundational concepts in comics. And then I answer questions live. So if people have questions about what they're working on or what's happening in the industry or anything like that, they can just ask those questions. The next episode is going to be, let's see, one on November 1st, and it's going to be one on November 15th.
November 15th. And you answer questions live. So it's a live podcast?
Yeah, it's a live podcast. It's on Saturdays at 3 p.m. Eastern.
Saturdays, 3 p.m. On what platform? Through your website?
On YouTube, Instagram,
okay,
and TikTok.
Perfect.
I believe.
Those are the same three I use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's awesome. I'm going to go check out your website and video and podcast. I'm probably going to be your next number one fan, but... this has been amazing. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to bring up? The last thing I want is anybody to like, you know, walk away and be like, dang, I wish you would ask me this, right?
One thing that I always wrap up with you when I'm doing panels, when I'm doing presentations or anything like that, is the idea that nothing that I say in terms of the legal aspects of comics, or the financial aspects of comics, or the business of comics should stop you from making comics. 100%. This is all to help you understand the process and to not get burned by the process in the way there's a famous quote from like Jack Kirby that comics will break your heart. Comics will break your heart if you don't understand how comics work when you go to make comics. If you understand how it works, you understand what a freelance deal is, what it is that you're giving up, what it is you should be getting. If you understand what final order cutoff date is, if you understand what bleed is, if you understand what a page rate is and what it isn't, you understand all of these things, what royalties are and all this other kind of stuff, you can have less trepidation and less nervousness about the process, which will help make you more confident to go make the comic you want to make. I think everybody should, if you're interested in comics, you should be making comics. I also think you should just understand how the process works so you are not blindsided by something you did not understand. But what I don't want is people to not make comics because I'm talking about trademarks and taxes and infringement and all that stuff. That's not should not be a barrier to you making comics.
I agree. I agree. You know, You just do it. Sole proprietorship works too. You know, learn how to do that. Get a good accountant. We'll help you all day long with that. And you can write off a lot of stuff. This paper, this pen, this microphone, this hat, like everything's a write-off. So that's what I say. You know, every mile I drive is a write-off. I'm going to actually cut that. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I don't have a car, so I don't, it's not, you know, it's not a thing.
Well, I guess living in New York City, you don't need a car, right? Subway everywhere.
Exactly.
Right.
You're going to put a car.
I saw, there's an awesome video about that. Some like big rich guy goes to get a loan and like puts his car as collateral, goes away for 5 days, comes back, pays off the loan, paid like $18 of interest. And you're like, why did you get the loan? He's like, where else can I park my car for $18 in New York City? I thought that was fantastic. All right, I have some fun questions I ask everybody. These are just kind of fun. Who was your first favorite superhero?
Favorite superhero is probably going to be Nightcrawler.
Ooh, I love Nightcrawler. That was awesome. Do you remember the first comic book you ever read?
And this may or may not be accurate, but I believe my first comic was, I think, Batman 152 or 135. It was a Batman with the Return of Joker that Neil Adams did. And I want to say this was in the mid-70s. It was probably not a comic that a six-year-old should be reading, but it was awesome.
Right?
And, yeah.
That's awesome. Do you read any current... Do you have a favorite current series?
I'm currently reading Storm now, because Storm is my favorite Marvel character. Okay. I'm also reading Black Cat. I'm also catching up on Elektra and Daredevil. And I just finished the Titan put out a omnibus of Blade Runner 2019. So I just finished reading that omnibus. That was actually very well done. And now I can go read Blade Runner 2029 and 2039 because now I've caught up on 2019. I got to find Black Lotus, not Black Lotus, Tokyo, whatever it was. That fills in because I have the timeline of where it all fits. So I'm trying to read it in order.
All right. Because you said Storm, I have to ask, because I read a couple of the recent Storm, the Thunder Ward. What do you think of that?
It seems like they are, it's not trade weighted the way it's actually playing itself out, but it is a thing that Marvel, I believe, has been doing pretty consistently since Civil War, which is like a jigsaw puzzle style of storytelling, wherein, let's say you and I are reading Storm. Okay, that's great. But by issue 3, all of a sudden, X-Man Hunt, that whole storyline comes in. And you're like, okay, wait, what happened? And then they just stop talking about it. And then they go talk about something else. And you're like, okay. Every individual issue on its own is actually very well done. The art is good. The dialogue is good. The pacing is good. It's fine. But as a overall narrative arc, you actually needed to read 36 other comics that were not Storm to actually understand what's happening. And on a certain level, I get it because they're trying, they're trying to do is to get more, a smaller and smaller number of monthly comic book buyers. They're trying to get them to buy more and more comics to cover the spread.
Gotcha. Right?
But what they are then doing, and this is a direct result of the fact that we have comic book shops. Because if you look at comics like that, those Thors that you have sitting behind you were probably released when there were newsstands, which meant that the comic had to have, the story had to have a beginning, middle, and end within those, within the cover. You cannot, could not say, oh, wait till the next issue when this, that, and the other, because the way newsstands worked back then, 1 month, a particular newsstand might have Green Arrow, the next they might have Green Lantern, the next they might have Spider-Man, and it's not going to be consistent.
It's not. And that used to make me so mad as a kid.
But that's where comic book conventions came from, because people looking to complete, you know, their collections, they couldn't go to the same comic book stand, the newsstand. They had to go find other people who wanted to buy and sell comics with them and trade comics. That's where comic conventions came from. That's also where comic book shops came from, because Bud Selig and all the people who started up comic book stores, they really wanted a place they could actually get the comics consistently, which created a whole different set of problems later on, one of which was trade waiting, one of which is this kind of jigsaw method of doing things, one of which is actually decreasing the actual value of any individual comic, because they'll just print more comics. You increase supply, you reduce demand, and then the very rare comic is not very rare. Just look at Death of Superman.
Right. Very good point. I wasn't thrilled with the Thunder War, the couple issues I read of it. I'm like, I really thought it would be better. And like you said, the X-Men hunt, I was really into. I read all the core issues. Mm-hmm. And then the ending was just meh. Like, I don't know.
Because keep in mind, the whole crossover kind of mega like event used to be in the 80s and 90s only during the summer. During the rest of the year, every title would pretty much be on its own. You know, Captain America do Captain America things, Spider-Man doing Spider-Man things, X-Men are doing X-Men things. But at a certain point, and I believe this was in 2010, 2012, they just decided every event was going to just lead into another event. So now it's just this rolling cycle where it's very hard to find a comic book series that's not always tied into everything else that's going on. And this is specifically Marvel. I do not know if DC is doing the same thing, but I think only, from what I remember, Moon Knight and Black Widow. You can read those and you don't really need to know what's going on in the rest of them, because they're not doing that. They're doing Moon Knight, Black Widow, which is great.
I do love League of Comic Geeks. I use that to, like, you know, my pull list and track all my comics and everything. It does a good, decent job of telling you if it's a core issue or just a tie-in. So you can kind of decide which ones you get. So that's been helpful. So yeah, I told you we'd get sidetracked. If you could live in any comic book universe, which one would it be?
I would actually not want to live in any comic book universe. Have you seen these places? Like, think about it for a minute. Well, I think the only one, I would say Grendel from Matt Wagner. Only because if you are not actually a criminal, you should be fine. There's not a lot happens to everybody else. It's not like a Marvel DC situation. You just be walking to the post office and a car hits you because
Spider-Man threw it at Hulk.
Exactly.
Or,
like,
you know, whatever.
That doesn't happen. In Grendel, none of those things happen.
If you mind your business, you're good. A lot of people revert back to the Sunday morning comic strips, you know, in the paper, you know, like Peanuts and Garfield. And I'm like, man, those are good ones. A cat eating lasagna.
Yeah, because you're safe. Like, what's the worst that could happen to you?
Exactly.
You try to kick a football and you'd miss. Okay, that's fine. I'll take it. So
that happens every park in America. All right, if you could have any superpower, what would it be?
That would be photogenic reflexes.
What was it?
Photogenic reflexes.
Okay.
Taskmaster.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Because all the things that you watch on TV, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do it. Yeah, now you can.
Now you can. I love that. All right, which comic book character would you want as your sidekick? Any character. Doesn't have to be a sidekick. They're your sidekick now.
I think I would have to just go with Storm. Because then, like, I'm not really doing anything. I'm just...
Yeah, you're just hanging out, right? Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the weather's always nice. Yeah.
As long as she's happy, right? Yeah. All right. If your life were a comic book, what would the title be? That's a lot.
How did I get here?
How did I get here? I like that.
Yeah, because there's not a straight line progression between going to law school and becoming a fairly prominent comic book attorney. Because comic book attorney is not actually a thing. It's not like malpractice attorney or mergers and acquisitions attorney. comic book attorney is like, wait, what? There's no law school you can go to. It's like, I want to train to be a comic book attorney. Like they show you the door because that's not a thing.
I thought you were going to say cursed in the profession because he used that when we first got on.
No. How did I get here would be the, that would be the.
How did I get here? I love it. So how did you, what made you want to be a lawyer to start with?
I didn't want to be a lawyer. What do you mean? I lost a bet and I wound up in law school.
That's a heck of a bet to lose.
It is. It is, especially the way the bet was actually structured. The bet was with my mom. You know, mothers, if you're a Gen X, mothers wanted you to be doctor, lawyer, engineer. Like, those are literally the only three jobs they wanted.
My mom's in the other room. Don't let her hear.
Right. And there's a test that you have to take to see if you can get into law school in the first place. I didn't want to take this test because I didn't want to go to law school. She said, okay, I'll make you a bet. You take the test. If you don't do well in the test, I won't bother you about law school anymore. If you do well in the test, then you go to law school. So I registered for the test on the last day. There was a prep class for the test. I did not take them. I walked into, this was back when you could only use like number two pencil to fill in the bubbles. I took one pencil. I said, if the pencil breaks, I'm out. It's over. Took the test, test results came back, and there was like one, I got accepted to three law schools, and one law school was going to give me a scholarship. So that was lost in a most spectacular fashion. And then I was in law school.
That gave you a scholarship.
Yeah, but I lost the scholarship in like the first year. So it's not like.
So you still had to shell out for it.
Yeah, it was still like $200,000. I mean, yeah, I got the first year free, but yeah.
It's a lot of money. What law school did you go to?
New York Law School, right downtown.
Right downtown. That's awesome, man. What did you want to be? Comic book writer?
No, I originally decided that I was going to work for the State Department, going to be in the diplomatic service, then realized that if you're a diplomat, you have to go to wherever they send you. You don't decide where you're going to go. They decide where you want to go, and they can send you to some pretty horrible places. And you have to actually do and present whatever position the current administration wants. Now, whether or not you agree with that is not really relevant. So I was not necessarily keen on just being randomly sent to Botswana and be stuck there for 7 years, like trying to explain to them why we're exploiting all their resources. So I decided I wasn't going to.
Creating those bad contracts.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it. I think you're doing amazing work. I've been following your stuff online for a couple months, and you know, this has been amazing for me talking to you. I really appreciate you the time. I'd love to have you back one day.
Absolutely.
Everybody go to the, you know, I'll have all the links in the description and all that. Follow him, follow me, follow everybody, like, share, comment, all that fun stuff. But thank you so much for coming and being on with me.
Absolutely. Anytime.
In a world of heroes, villains, and epic stories,
Braha, Onicon, and their ultimate sidekick, Panel P, take you on adventures each week.
Showing off their comic book hauls,
fun trivia and games, honest reviews,
and inspiring conversations with creators and consumers who make it all possible.
Join in on the conversation.
This is Talking Comics.
Trying to start a podcast but feeling stuck? At Aquatio, we help creators make waves with everything you need to bring your voice to life. Hosting, recording, editing, and marketing. Whether you're starting from scratch or just need a little help polishing your sound, we're here to hydropower your creativity. Comment on this video or DM us today and let's dive in.